Welcome to the latest Tablet podcast. My name is Ruth Gledsel and I'm assistant editor of the Tablet. With me today I have Magnus McFarlane Barrow, the founder of the international school feeding charity Mary's Meals. Mary's Meals grew out of a charity called Scottish International Relief. And this was set up after Magnus and his brother Fergus took aid from their home in Argyll to Medjugorje in Bosnia-Herzegovina in 1992 during the conflict there. Magnus, how did this come about exactly, and what was it about being in Medjugorje that inspired you to set up this charity that's now grown to have such an incredible effect all around the world in helping to relieve poverty and hunger?
Well, I suppose maybe that effort we made to help the people in Bosnia and the aid we took to Medjugorje, that wasn't our first visit to Medjugorje. We'd actually been there many years before that, when I was, I think, only 14 years of age. And that was 1983. And I'd gone out there with my brothers and sister, really in a kind of an adventure. We'd read this little report saying there were reports of the Virgin Mary appearing to teenagers in Yugoslavia, as it was then. So we went out there to kind of investigate, I suppose, as teenagers, and have this adventure. It was still a communist country. It was before Medjugorje had become a place of international pilgrimage. And we had this experience there that really just kind of profoundly changed us, certainly in terms of a renewal of our own faith. We had been raised, I suppose, in a fairly devout Catholic family, but it really renewed our faith. And in time, led my mother and father, who after our visit went themselves, it led them to make this kind of, I suppose, fairly radical choice to turn our home into a house of prayer. It had been a guest house, and they turned it into what became Craig Lodge Family House of Prayer, just invite stay who wanted to pray with us. And so that's the kind of, I think, for me, a very important backdrop to the whole, that work that came when my brother and I felt prompted to take that aid when the war broke out 10 years later. I suppose a large part of why we felt so passionate and wanted to do something to help the people there was because of that experience we'd had many years earlier. And it's also interesting to me, you know, because of that choice my mum and dad made, this place had been a place of prayer where people were gathered around the Blessed Sacrament for 10 years before this work was ever unexpectedly born. And for me, that's really significant.
And the charity then was called Scottish International Relief, wasn't it? And was it just focused in Bosnia-Herzegovina, or did it have a wider brief?
Well, it began absolutely just literally driving trucks back and forth to Bosnia-Herzegovina, all over Bosnia and Croatia during that war. And then, still in the name of Scottish International Relief, we began being invited to work in some other countries. So, for example, Romania probably was the next one. We began working there with children who were HIV positive, who'd been abandoned in hospitals and were just neglected in every sense of the word. And with these amazing local Romanian volunteers, we began building homes for those children, family-style home environments, and began taking those children out of this particular hospital. And that was a huge learning experience
for me. I just
saw miracle, like literally incredible miracles happen there. I saw how God really can transform situations that look hopeless, and that experience really encouraged me to go on. And we in other countries working with street children in Latin America, working with people during that terrible civil war. So a variety of places, but real no, prior to Mary's Meals being born, no real focus or theme.
We were really just responding
to various requests for help whenever we thought we could help. So a whole mixture of different kinds of work at that stage.
And were you doing this full time with your life?
Yes, I mean at the beginning when my brother and I took aid out to Medjugorje in 1992, I'd only intended it to be one. I took 1 week's holiday from work, literally. I was a fish farmer, a salmon farmer, and I came back at the end of that week fully intending to go back to the fish farm to work as normal. And I when I came back that time, I discovered this mountain of food and aid donations, and it kept coming. I couldn't stop it, and so I prayed about it and decided at that point to give up my job and sold my house. And I said to God, I'll keep doing this as long as there's a need and as long as people keep giving. I certainly didn't understand at that point it was going to be like a lifelong work that God was giving me to do. I thought maybe it would be a few months or even a year, but from that point on, I've been working on this full time for the last 30 years or more.
So it's quite a moving story, isn't it, about how this grew into Mary's Meals. Could you tell it
Yeah.
us in your words what happened?
Sure. Yeah. So yeah. So by 20 by 2002, we've been
Doing
doing
this work
work under
under
the
the name
name
of
of Scottish International Relief for 10 years, and that year we found
found us
ourselves
working.
working in Malawi for the first time. It was a year of terrible hunger, of famine in southern Africa, and Malawi was especially affected by that. At one point, millions of people facing starvation. So we were there doing very simple emergency feeding projects, working in particular villages where we said to the people, "We'll stay with you until your next harvest," and we were bringing food in from the cities. And I was staying with a local parish priest, and one morning he said, "Magnus, do you want to come with me when I go to visit the sick in my parish?" And before we entered the first home, he ex explained to me that the father of this family had just died and that the mother was now dying. And when we went in to visit her, Emma, the mum, was lying on the floor, and she was in agony, and she was surrounded by her six children. And she said to us, "There's nothing left for me now except to pray that someone's going to look after my children when I'm gone." And then I started talking to her oldest child, sitting beside her, and he was called Edward, and he was 14 years of age. And at one point in the conversation, I asked Edward, what's your hope? What's your dream?" And he said to me, I'd like to have enough food to eat, and I would like to be able to go to school one day." And that was it. That was all of his ambition at 14 years of age. And it was really, I'd encountered children like him many times before that, in school because of hunger, because of poverty. But that answer of his that day really made me think about that in a new way, about that horrible cycle
Cycle
of
of
poverty that millions and millions of children are trapped in. They're hungry, so they have to work, they have to beg, they have to do whatever they have to do to survive, and therefore only possible ladder out of poverty. And so it was, I love the fact that it was the words of a child that ignited this mission and really prompted us with that idea. One meal every day served in a place of education could break that cycle of poverty. So yeah, I love the way God prompted this mission.
And what's happened to Edward, do you know?
Well, it's painful because I tried to find him in the years after we began Mary's Meals, and I did find him eventually. It was 2015 when I was, or 14 when I was writing. I wrote a book about the story of Mary's Meals, and I finally did manage to find him after a lot of effort. And I knew it was going to be a painful meeting because Mary's Meals came too late for Edward. He was already 14 when I'd met him. We didn't get to his area of Malawi until 3 or 4 years after that. And so yes, when I met him, his life was tough, has been very tough. But it was an amazing encounter, because I asked him at one point, "Have you heard of Mary's Meals?" And because by that point we were already feeding about a million children around the world, and he said, "Yeah, I've heard of Mary's Meals. I think they feed children in two or three schools around here." And And so I had the opportunity to explain them, yeah, that's true, but there's also this amazing thing that's happening all over the world, prompted by your words. And I don't know how many thousands of times I've repeated your words, and it's inspired so many people. And you know, there was a real pain to that as well, you know, that given his life and how tough it still is. And then this beautiful surprise came, which it turned out that his own son, who's called Blessing, had just begun primary school and was eating Mary's meals each day in school. So, and still does, to my knowledge, that child. So yeah, kind of painful and amazing at the same time, that encounter. And I've lost track of Edward. He's moved. I haven't seen him for a few years now.
So now Mary's Meals feeds an incredible 2.5 million children every day at school in 18 different countries across Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean. I mean, this is really incredible. How many staff do you have, and how on earth do you manage this?
Yeah, I mean, I agree, Ruth. It's really incredible, and I never lose this sense of surprise. Literally every day after all these years, I still have this sense of surprise. Like, how did this happen? You know, and this huge sense of gratitude. I really, it's a miracle. It's a sign of God's mercy in this world in a very particular way. And I don't claim to even understand it all fully myself, but I understand some of it. And yeah, we would have several hundred paid staff around the world, most of them in the countries where we serve the meals. You know, so big teams in Malawi, and you know, in Malawi alone, we feed 1 million children every day. So a fairly big team there, a big team in Zambia next door, in Liberia, and then teams also here in Scotland, where the head quarters are, so to speak, although that's becoming more and more dispersed, that global team around the world. And then small teams in the countries where we fundraise. We have Mary's Meals fundraising organizations in 15 different countries as well. But those numbers of paid staff are very, very small compared to the numbers of volunteers involved in this mission. So to give you an idea, just in Malawi alone, there would be certainly over 50,000 volunteers involved in the daily work of cooking and serving these meals. So first and foremost, we're a movement of volunteers and people giving freely. And then there's a small number of us who are privileged to be paid staff to support that.
So I was going to ask about the logistics. You know, how do you actually get this food to the children in their schools?
Yeah, well, a key part of the model is from the beginning, a desire to buy the food locally. So we're supporting the local smallholder farmer. We're contributing to the local economy, and that's a key part of our model. And that's what we do whenever we can. Now, there's some situations where we can't do that today, where there's conflicts. So South Sudan, or Haiti, or you know, Liberia right now, we're not able to source all our food in country, but we do as much as we can in country. In Malawi, our biggest program, everything that we serve the kids is grown and produced within Malawi, which is a wonderful thing. So yes, there's challenging logistics sometimes about moving food within the country, and then sometimes in those challenging conflict situations, we're having to move food in from outside into those very difficult environment. So yeah, there are constant logistical challenges, and we've got fantastic people working on that with real expertise. But I would say even maybe
That local owner.
ownership model, where you know th this is genuinely you know, in a day community, and the leaders of the local communities in which we serve the meal, they own the project, and they figure out and solve the problems around logistics in a really crucial way.
So one of the things that's most destructive to a child's education is hunger. If a child is too hungry, it's very difficult for them to be able to learn effectively. They can't concentrate, they can't remember, they just want to eat. And obviously they get very depressed. So have you done any data, or have you got any data, or any done any research about how this food that the children are getting is having an effect on the educational ladder?
Yeah, yes, we certainly are. I mean, that's something that we feel passionate about in the more recent years of this work is to collect the data and build this body of evidence that does prove that this works, and thereby encourage other people, governments and other policymakers to prioritize this. That, you know, we believe that every child in this world should at least be able to eat one meal every day in their place of education. And we know that in this world there's more than enough food for everyone. That's possible. So we want to prove how important this is. So yes, so we would collect on an ongoing basis data around enrollment increases, attendance rates of children. These things dramatically improve after Mary's Meals begin. Children who used to come just some days begin coming every day. Enrollment, when children know about the promise of the meal, many children who never came to school before begin coming for the first time. So we see these huge increases in enrollment. And then over a longer period of time, we see this improvement in academic performance. We see a huge improvement in children progressing through school rather than dropping out along the way. We see an increase of girls and boys in school. You know, when we look globally at the 2.5 million children being fed, or 2.4 million children being fed, it's almost exactly 50-50 boys and girls, which is pretty amazing given some of the environments that we are working in. But actually, to pick up on the point you just made there, Ruth, about, you know, something we might not think about so much with hunger, and we're measuring this too, is just the awful anxiety that causes, you know, both for parents who just don't know how they're going to feed their children tomorrow, let alone in the weeks and months to come, and for the children themselves. So some of the surveys we do, you know, we would, before we start in a serving meals in a school, we would go in and do these baseline surveys, sitting down with the community, and they wouldn't know that it's Mary's Meals asking the questions at that point or further down the line. And we would ask questions about happiness, ask the children about their happiness, ask the children about their levels of anxiety at school. And it's quite incredible to see how those things change when we go back 3 months later, 6 months later, about how many more children are saying they're happy at school, how many are much less anxious at school. So yeah, I never, when we set out in that kind of data collection stuff, I didn't imagine we'd be able to measure happiness, but that's been one of the most amazing things that's come through, actually.
It truly is amazing. I mean, you know, it isn't too much to, you know, to talk about miracles here. It's really incredible what you're doing. So I know you said earlier on that prayer was a cornerstone of all this work, and we're just coming to the end of May when we're recording this, and you've had your Pray in May kind of initiative going on. So just tell me a little bit about the role of prayer and the effect you think it's had on the whole Mary's Meals initiative.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because in on one hand, you know, Mary's Meals is this universal mission. You know, people of all faiths and no faiths, people who pray and people who don't pray, are involved in this simple work to feed the hungry child. And then at the same time, I don't think you could exaggerate the place of prayer in Mary's Meals. I would, and I do often, describe Mary's Meals as a fruit of prayer. You know, that I would say that very deliberately, both for the reason I explained earlier about the history of Mary's Meals and how it grew out of this place of prayer here where I live in Scotland, and I still am based in a little shed right beside that house of prayer that continues, and I choose to stay here very much for that reason. You know, so prayer was happening for 10 years before this work was unexpectedly born, and it wasn't a work that was ever planned by me or by anyone else. It wasn't a product of human thinking. But it's not just a historical fact, it's a daily living out of that in lots of different ways. You know, there's a Mary's Meal, simple little Mary's Meals prayer that many of us pray every day all over the world. We would have a daily prayer group online that people from all over the Mary's Meals family join. We have we still have an annual pilgrimage to Medjugorje, those who want to join from different parts of the Mary's Meals family. And then you mentioned Pray in May. So many different initiative priests who organise holy hours on a regular basis to invite people to come and pray for Mary's Meals. So it's, you know, I was in Haiti recently in the mountains there in a very impoverished community, and I was meeting with some of these amazing women who volunteer despite their own real poverty and challenge with hunger. They volunteer their time as their gift every day to this movement to feed the children in their community. And I was asking a few people in Haiti just a simple question: what's Mary's Meals for you? What does it mean for you? And I asked this particular volunteer, this lady, that question, and she said, for me, Mary's Meals is an answer to prayer. It's an answer to the prayer we parents have been making for our hungry children, you know, and that just moved me so much, that answer, that, you know, because I agree with her. It is. So, yeah. And linked to that, Ruth, is just this belief that Mary's Meals is really an expression of God's providence, you know, of his love for the little ones, for the very poorest. And we see it played out over and over again. These things I can only describe as miracles, these experiences we have where God doesn't only give us what we need, which he does. He does it in a way that we can't help but realize it's him. It's him that's done it, not us. You know, We're as much reliant on prayer and God's providence as we ever were.
Now, you've mentioned South Sudan and Haiti and Malawi, but I also know that Ethiopia is a particular area of interest at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, and an area of huge pain and suffering. You know, there's been this awful conflict in Tigray, you know, and there is a peace that's holding right now at long last. Tigray's an example of how much Mary's Meals is also reliant on these incredible local partner organizations and their leadership. So because of the very difficult situation in Tigray right now and the real risk that our partners there face, we need to be, we're careful about revealing their identity exactly, but they're Catholic nuns, and they are the most incredible people who've just remained. And I was talking to them on a regular basis during the worst of the conflict, whenever communications were possible. And, you know, just the way they would talk about staying there, one of them, who's a friend of mine, lost 13 members of her own family in this conflict and just saw this absolute horror, the very worst of war and the evil that occurs in wars like that. And yet she stayed. And what she said overall is, I know I'm called to be the voice of the voiceless here, because there was that huge suffering caused by the fact, or this sense that the world was paying no attention to these atrocities happening at a huge scale. And they wanted to be the voice. And they also, on a more practical level, wanted to stay simply to keep helping the people who were finding themselves displaced. And because they stayed, we were able to keep sending funding, and they were able to keep feeding people during the worst of that horror. Now, we're not quite back to normal there yet, and we're getting there, though. Some of the areas in which we've been working for many years have finally opened up again because of this peace deal, and we're able to, through those amazing sisters, reach those communities again. We're now waiting for schools to reopen in those places so we can resume Mary's Meals and our normal work there.
Now, I know that more than 500,000 people died in the conflict alone, and probably many more starved to death. It's one of the poorest and countries in the world, and it's incredibly plagued by drought. And almost one third of the entire population is below the international poverty line, which is only $1.9 a day. So, it's just unspeakable, really, the difficulties of living in that kind of environment, and where just surviving becomes all that anyone wants to do. And, you know, it is a kind of a miracle, I keep using that word, but it's a kind of miracle if you can get in there, and if the schools can reopen and your work can start up again. So how, because I know you were in there before, weren't you, with the before the conflict closed all the schools across Tigray. How long do you think it might be before the schools can reopen again?
Well, those, as I say, it's actually just literally in the last this last week or so that we've had the wonderful news that our partners have been able to get back into those villages, those communities where we used to serve the meals, and are doing this emergency feeding there right now, and discovering really awful, dire situations and circumstances. But that does give us hope that the next step would be for those schools to reopen. Now, we know already many of the schools have been destroyed completely. Many of them have been very badly damaged, but may be repaired. So there's a lot of work to do. I would hope that some, even makeshift temporary solutions are found to get children learning again. And as soon as that happens, we'll be wanting to provide a meal, because we never wait for everything to be perfect in that regard. In South Sudan today, in that war, we're working with these amazing nuns there who created these tent schools, right in one of the worst areas of conflict, where they have children learning under canvas, because it's better than children not learning at all. And that's again an example where we provide the meals in those temporary schools, and the children come because of the promise of a meal, but there they start to gain this education. So as soon as we can get back to that in Tigray, we will, and I'm so grateful for you raising it, actually, because I do in a very particular way feel like that Tigray conflict, it did get some media attention, but when you actually look at the scale of that war and the horror of it, it didn't receive much media attention. And that's something that I think is, there's a broader point around that, I think, in these times where, having been doing this work for many years now, I do feel it's harder than ever to draw attention to the world's very poorest people. And I understand it at one level, given what's going on in the world, and there's so much uncertainty that everyone's facing in different ways, and so much economic hardship in our own country, and I get that. And I sympathize with that, but it does make it easy for us to forget sometimes about, I mean, you touched on some moving statistics there. I mean, if you think about it globally, today in the world, it's now 1 in 9 people are struggling with chronic hunger. 1 in 9, in this world that where we produce more than enough food for all of us, so there's this real risk that we need to combat about us not listening anymore to the voices of the very poorest in the world. But it's not easy right now.
No, I really get that. If anyone listening wanted to donate to the Crisis in Ethiopia Appeal, where would they go to do that?
If they just go on, our websites, just type in Mary's Meals, you'll find our website, and you'll see different ways to support. You can support our work generally, because we're in desperate need of help, and in many different places of the world. And you'll also see where you can donate specifically to Tigray if you wish to do that.
So besides Ethiopia, what are the other kind of trouble hotspots that you're focusing on at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, sadly, there's no shortage of those. And again, I would definitely say in the 30 years I've been doing this kind of work, I definitely cannot remember a time where there have been so many concurrent crises unfolding. So there's the one we've just talked about in Tigray. There's whole of East Africa impacted by just this recurring drought situation. So Turkana in northern Kenya, which always struggles at the best of times with hunger, that's a fifth so-called rainy season come and gone without rain. Huge rates of malnutrition there. Similar, Madagascar's really struggled with that in recent years. Haiti, which is one of our biggest projects, we have a situation there really where the government isn't functioning. That huge parts of the country are being run by armed gangs, horrible violence occurring in the communities where we feed children. So just, and I could go on. You know, that there are so many crises at the moment, and you know, underlying, you know, there's those particular local situations, some of which I've just described, and then, you know, the economic impact of the war in Ukraine, especially in the form of costs of food just going up and up and up and very rapidly in some of the poorest places. It just simply means, regardless of whether there happens to be a conflict or a drought going on, many, many millions of people who were on the edge of just being able to afford enough food for their family now simply can't, you know. And so we see that all the countries we're working in, we see that many, many thousands more people are in desperate need of help, and many more children desperately in need of Mary's Meals.
Well, thank you, Magnus. I know you're shortly off on your travels again to a community in need. And I hope that sometime later this year we can touch base again and you can tell us more of the vivid stories that you hear out there. Because I think one thing we at the Tablet can do to help is to bring this to people's attention by hearing the voices of people such as yourself to give these vivid descriptions of what's happening over there. And In these places that are almost so difficult to really imagine and understand for those of us living these more comfortable lives in the West.
I'd love to take
it on board. And I'm sure people, when they hear and know about it in the terms of which you describe so vividly, will want to help.
I'd love to do that, Ruth, and I'm really grateful for all the great work the Tablet already does. You're amazing in terms of the stories that you cover, and I would love the opportunity to come back and tell you more stories. And you know, I do want to say, while I've been talking about just the reality of this increase in suffering in the world, there's a real risk, I think, that we all get overwhelmed by that. And you know, wherever I go, I encounter these stories of hope continually. You know, like you were asking me earlier about the data that proves that this works, and we're doing that, but much more, I think, moving than that even is just all these young adults that I meet today that will tell me, I never would have gone inside a school ever if it wasn't for Mary's Meals. And there they are in further education or paid employment, or they've started businesses. And, you know, so there's that, we call them Generation Hope. You know, these thousands of young people that are making things better in their communities, and all these amazing leaders and volunteers. So, you know, it's certainly not all bad news either. There is lots of reasons to be hopeful that things can get better. You know, and then we can play this small part in that by, in our case, providing that meal every day that gives those young people a chance of changing things. So, yeah, I'd love to come back in the future and share more of those stories too.
Well, I just love that. Generation Hope. What a great mission. Thank you, Magnus. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll be back soon with more news from Mary's Meals.